Santa Claus sitting in a sauna by the sea, many majestic modern museums, and fantastic filling food. All this can be yours when you choose Helsinki to host the 2017 World Science Fiction Convention. Where else can you enjoy 17 hours of sunlight while exploring an 18th century island sea fortress? The home of Angry Birds and Linux is calling. Come be a part of the excitement as you enjoy all of this and the World Science Fiction Convention in 2017. Make sure to vote Helsinki in 2017. For more information on how to help Helsinki host the World Science Fiction Convention, please visit www.helsinkiin2017.org.
Danger! The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution.
At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T-5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show.
Middleman Disc 2, Art Crawl!
I was hoping that was going to be the tagline.
I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
Art Crawl!
I'm Paul, Art Crawl!
And I'm Mike, other Art Crawl!
And we're here to talk about The Middleman. If it was not already clear from the initial reference on this episode, thank you for that, Mike. I appreciate that.
I live for the Art Crawl.
It was a very fun episode, yes.
I want everyone to know that I did, like, pump my fist in the air when I said it.
Of course.
That is wonderful. That's great. So we're here to talk about the next 4 episodes of the first and only season of The Middleman. Those will include the flying fish zombification, the boy band superfan interrogation. These titles are amazing. The cursed tuba contingency, and the ectoplasmic panhellenic investigation. So, yay. In any case, we should maybe just dive right in, right?
Yeah.
All right, so let's start right off the bat with episode 5, the flying fish zombification. Start, I guess, with some general reactions. I'll just start with you, Julia.
This makes me constantly make the jumping and putting my hands in the air sign for the energy drink every time I see it. But it's really hard to explain that if it's, you know, if you're not in front of me. There's no visual.
Yeah, this is the one episode that is incredibly performative by comparison to some of the others, because there's Art Crawl, which appears, and everybody kind of, when they repeat that name, they kind of bounce up and they do their whole thing. Like, as you said, Julia, right, you put your
Art
fist
Crawl.
Up. Art Crawl. And then there's what's the drink called? It's just like a sound.
Yeah, Mike just said the name.
Yeah. Which is also really just amusing. So it's
spelled 4 exclamation points, but it's pronounced. And that's where you stomp one foot on the ground and put both hands in the air with your fingers up.
You do kind of like jazz hands almost. Yeah. Yeah, it's a fun episode, I think. One of the more just kind of completely insane episodes. This also involves zombified people who crave trout.
Trout.
I love this show. So excellent. So what other reactions do you want to offer, Julia?
What other reactions do I want to offer? I don't know. I mean, I really like it. It's a lot of fun. I enjoy the energy drink. I also really enjoy the point at which Wendy is battling a zombie trout and the middleman is on the phone to Ida and, like, totally doesn't notice the giant epic battle going on in the background.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mike, you want to jump in?
Yeah, this is a wonderful comedy technique that's serious foreground, silly background, which shows up in the very first episode. Where Wendy is on the phone with her mom, and then the tentacle monster alien recombined DNA thing is happening behind her. So that kind of foreground background is a recurring comedic trope in the series.
Also, hey, Mr. God.
Oh gosh, yeah, that particular character.
The pretty girls with their prettily painted toenails.
What you about just know me? That
Pip, you just know that Pip is in Gamergate now.
Oh God! You just took it to a whole new level, Julia. Whew.
Well, it's right there at the end of "Hey, Mr. God." What about me?
That's true. Yeah. Well, we should probably offer some explanation because we're talking about lots of things. So we should maybe describe what the episode's about, other than Trout and I can't do it. I can't do the stompy sound effect. But I mean, the basic premise is that there is a weird infection going around in which presumably it's a zombie infection. There's all kinds of zombie references. There's a beautiful point when the middleman is reading like a guide to zombies, which is amusing. And they have to essentially figure out what's going on and stop the infection before it ends. And then the sort of subplot to that is that Lacey, her photogenic roommate, is running what is being called an art crawl, which is apparently just like a giant art festival inside of their illegal sublet. And it's kind of the tensions between the job and life, I guess, which appears throughout many of the episodes, that kind of that theme. So, so there's all kinds of just wonderful craziness going on, I think. But what about you, Paul? What do you want to add?
Well, to get a little more serious for a moment, as far as this episode being lots of fun and funny is, this episode also hits that and explores the whole work-life balance.
Right.
Which is an interesting point. It makes makes references to the making time for friends and not letting a job consume you or define you. And in the midst of flying fish and energy drinks with strange stuff in it and all that other stuff, it actually has a serious point. It was just almost like, as Mike said, you almost got like the foreground and the background. That's more background. In the foreground, you have the comedy. In the background, you have actually a serious point that the show is trying to make in this episode.
That's fair. Yeah. Mike?
Yeah, something that I particularly liked about this episode is the relationship triangulation and tension between the middleman, Wendy, and the absent but very present presence-wise Sensei Ping, where Wendy goes in for the martial arts training, and then there's a bit of kind of jockeying back and forth about being his favorite student, and then we see the teachings of Sensei Ping manifest in these ridiculous kung fu flowery name techniques like Ping's River and like the Three Devils, which I enjoy as a martial arts kind of cinema, Hong Kong cinema fan, and it also puts a slightly different light on the Wendy and middleman relationship, where there's a bit they're almost more on a level with regards to Sensei Ping's kind of mentorship in his favor.
There's also, this is the first time we actually learn anything about Lacey's background, and we find out the character of Barbara Thornfield, MD, PhD, who is Lacey's mother, and really far too busy and important to be part of Lacey's life. And then through that, you kind of get to see a little bit more of how Lacey and Wendy's friendship is so strong, and maybe why it is so strong.
Oh, go ahead, Mike.
Well, and I think the direct contrast there is Wendy trying to contrast herself to Barbara, Barbara Thornfield, MD, PhD, by being present for Lacey, by not missing out on art crawl. So she, you know, does everything within her power to be there for Lacey, but the job is managing to be in the way, which means that from Wendy's standpoint, she's worried that she's letting her friend down, which is really disastrous because Lacey is so much at the center of her world.
Yeah, and it's something that appears, I think, in a later episode where the middleman sort of awkwardly says, "I think of you as a brother." And that this idea that this whole unit is becoming almost kind of a surrogate family, which I don't think has really quite come up until this episode, I think, kind of starts to bring that out. I mean, obviously, Lacey and Wendy have that kind of relationship. They're very, very close. Best friends living in an illegal sublet. But I do appreciate that's something that's being brought up here, is that family element. Because we've heard from Wendy's mother via phone conversations, but we haven't heard, as Julia mentioned, right? We haven't heard from Lacey's side of it. And even by the end of the episode, Lacey's side is still basically absent, right? Because the running joke is that, you know, she'll show up for her daughter's stuff, but she always keeps, like, sometimes she'll show up. But if it's Henry Kissinger, right? If he calls, then all bets are off and that's the end of it. Henry Kissinger, is he dead?
Is he dead as of the time of this? As the time of the show? No. Is he dead now?
Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't remember. Anyway. No,
he's alive.
Okay.
91 now. Yeah.
But yeah, there's the point where Lacey calls her mother's office, and you hear only her side of the conversation, where she gets to the secretary and she's like, "May I speak with Barbara Thornfield, MD, PhD? And they're like, "Who is this?" And she says, "This is her daughter, Lacey. She only has the one.
Has the one.
Yeah.
Lacey Thornfield." Because they've obviously asked what her last name is. And she's like, you know, "I'm Barbara Thornfield's daughter."
Yeah, and that's... It's really kind of heartbreaking, because Wendy kind of pushes her, like, "You should invite your mom." And then that's kind of the conversation we get, which is just really... just sad.
Yeah, no, it's very sad. Very sad.
The parental units for both of them are interesting characters, especially by their absence. So I'm thinking of Wendy's father and how well Wendy had a relationship with her father. I mean, she learned how to fly jets thanks to her father. Her father's gone. And, well, Barbara Thornfield, MD, PhD, is never there for Lacey. So there's a kind of a sense of a bonding there between the two of them.
Yeah. Well, what about the flying, zombifying fish? To go on a more silly note.
I really like this. Sorry, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, what Mike said before, when we see the middleman talking and see the background, we see Wendy fighting this thing. That was hilarious. And then, of course, we're learning the front, that the middleman is like, "No, you don't have to. You know, don't kill it. It has to be alive." And we see Wendy just whopping out of, like, "Yeah, we kind of know what's going to come, but it's like she's gonna kill it, and it's." They're going to have to go further, but that's fine, because I can't imagine the plot going forward if she hadn't killed it, because then they could be sort of at a dead end if they just synthesize the antidote. But yeah, the whole reveal of what the energy drink is inside of it, and the evil plan, it's comedy gold.
And I think this is the first instance of my plan is sheer elegance in its simplicity.
Yes, it is.
Which will become a leitmotif for villains throughout the rest of the series.
Yeah, because another one, gosh, I feel like at least two other villains in the next two episodes have said that line. Am I wrong in that? Didn't the boy band group also say the same in episode 6, and also the tuba player in episode 7?
And also the physics major in episode eight.
That's right. Yeah, you're right.
I think it starts with Art Crawl, but it ends, it starts with the flying fish zombification, but it keeps going from there.
Right. Oh, another funny part, which is related, because the way this opens up is we learn that some guy, his recently married wife, had thrown an RV at him.
Yeah.
And he's in... I love that scene when they're in the hospital and the middleman closes the curtain because the guy's being really lethargic. He's kind of weird. And he just starts talking to Wendy. We all know that he can hear the conversation because it's just the hospital curtain. And he's just talking about how he's going to kill the guy, and then you hear him, like, crying. I love that just the absurdity of that scene. Like, and that as they continue talking, the guy is, like, crying in the background, thinking he's going to get shot in the head because they think he's a zombie. I love that scene. It's also kind of sad. Poor guy.
Well, it's also kind of a... horrible, horrible thing to do, but the middleman is doing it because he knows the man can hear and he wants to see if he reacts.
Right, right.
So the when he response, does, he's like, congratulations, you're not a zombie. And the guy's just like, what? and it's very much sort of like, wow, that was kind of a dick move, middleman.
Yeah.
Yeah, the middleman is incredibly efficient because he's dispassionate about zombies, whereas Wendy is super excited about zombies, even though in true middleman fashion, these don't end up being traditional zombies in the way that previous monsters have not been kind of traditional versions of those creatures. So Wendy's expert knowledge is somewhat undercut and then repositioned so that she's really engaged, but then she wants to be disengaged because she wants to be back at Art Crawl. So it's an interesting way of giving her kind of what she wants as a villain, but not in the way that she wants it or at the time she wants.
And yet she is pretty adept at handling the zombies, as it were. I mean, she handles the flying zombie-fying fish pretty well. Mm-hmm. You know, humorously, of course, as she's running back and forth like a cartoon character, being chased by it through the air. And she even, when her and the middleman end up in confrontations with multiple of the zombies, right, they do kind of come out of it. Although, granted, as you note, right, since they're not the traditional type of zombies, right, it's not the same kind of thing. She can't just go bashing them over the head. Although I think at that point they had, and they'd created the antidote, so there may have been an additional motivation not to bash them over the skull.
Right.
I did find it amusing that they spend a great deal of time tying zombies up in the secret lair, and then trying to have conversations with them, only to have the response be trout.
Trout. It's a subversion of what zombies are and what they represent and how to fight them. I mean, the whole dousing them with the trout guts before the villain unleashes the zombies. I was like, oh, so how are you going to get the zombies after them? Like, oh, that's how you get the zombies after them. Oh, ouch.
Okay, so I think we should probably move on to the next episode because we've been talking about this one for almost 15 minutes or maybe a bit more.
Sure.
But before we do, I just want to say the other thing that happens in this episode for the first time is Noser playing Stump the Band, which is the best thing ever. The audience basically asks him if he knows a song, and he says, yeah, I know it.
Yeah, that's it.
That's it.
Weird.
I don't know how it works. How does it work?
How to play Stump the Band without paying music licenses for your TV show.
Oh, that's clever.
And it's all based on whether or not Noser knows a song. Can you stump him? Probably not. He knows everything.
Fair enough.
At least when it comes to music.
Fair enough. Well, okay, so episode 6 is called the Boy Band Superfan Interrogation, which also goes in line with this idea of not having to pay licensing fees or convincing a boy band to actually show up.
No, that's a real boy band.
Is that a real boy band?
Varsity Fan Club is a real boy band.
Wait, are you... What? Why? No.
Look it up on the internet, man.
No.
That's how I know, because every time I'm like, so who is that boy band? And then every single time, this has happened like 3 times, Moss and I have kind of looked it up and been like, oh yeah, we looked this up last time. It's a real boy band called Varsity Fan Club.
What the frick? No, it is. It's real.
Like, I like how Sean didn't trust me.
How is... What?
I had always assumed it was made up.
So did I.
It's 100% real. I mean, they're just not quite as popular as NSYNC or the Backstreet Boys were in their heyday. Or
Active
One Direction
from 2006.
Now.
2006, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. In 2012, they announced that they will be changing their band name to Connor and Daniel's Fashionable Footwear.
What? What?
This sounds fake.
It sounds like a middleman plot.
It does, right?
Well, it sounds like something made up by aliens who are actually secretly horrible warlords.
I'm like
oligarchs as a boy band.
There is a Varsity Fan Club MySpace page. Oh my gosh. And there's a Varsity Fan Club iTunes page. Sweet Jesus, it is real.
But they're not really aliens, right?
Who knows?
It could be a double cover.
By the way, they are defined as a new boy band. That is NU-boy.
What's a new boy? Do I want to know?
It's just a silly way of saying they're like whatever the new generation of boy band. I don't even understand life anymore. Thanks, Julia.
Sure.
So should we describe the plot of this?
Yeah, someone else take the plot for me. Yeah.
Okay, so the warp holes are popping up around the city, and one of them has, I think, a duck that gets caught in it, and the middleman is like, oh, warp holes, this is incredibly dangerous, and they use all sorts of ridiculous Men in Black-style silly explanations and pop up orange cones to keep people back so they can investigate the portals. And there's some working back and forth with Ida and the Hadar to try and figure out where the other portals are. And they run into a preteen girl who's a super fan of the Varsity Fan Club, except that it turns out that she's much, much more. Do we want to go ahead directly into spoilers?
Yeah, honestly, why not? Yeah.
So she is actually a undercover warrior from the resistance group that's fighting back against these tyrants, and has been incarnated into a preteen body, even though she's like a veteran warrior 3 weeks from retirement. And she's browbeat a local community college, I think, science professor into getting all this tech, even though he doesn't really know anything about science. And the trick is that the superfan seems like they're the bad guy, except they're actually fighting back against the tyrants, who are the actual bad guys, trying to generate sufficient amounts of fandom and noise to power their interdimensional portal so that they can punch through space-time to get back to their home system as they've been exiled, having been deposed. So we get a lot of reversals and some double back kind of plot elements as Wendy and the middleman try and figure out exactly who's on which side in this whole kind of boy band ridiculosity.
And then we have the B plot with Wendy's art getting stolen.
Yes, where Pip has copied all of Wendy's paintings
and
is using them to get a gallery show.
And then threatened Wendy with eviction because, as we learned in the previous episode, his father owns the building. And so if she says anything or makes a big stink,
he will evict her and all of her friends.
Right. Right.
So their little kind of utopian art commune will be destroyed. So Wendy places the needs of others above her own kind of artistic ambitions.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because this is we see Lacey, right, trying to do her kind of activism thing. Coming up with all these schemes to kind of plot against him in order to kind of destroy his ability to basically steal and ride her thunder. And she's trying to stop them because she knows what's going to happen, but they don't really, and she doesn't, I don't know why she doesn't tell them, but she doesn't. She doesn't tell them until much later in the episode. I think maybe to kind of, just I guess, to protect them. I'm not sure. But, yeah. Interesting fact, the alien fighting against the boy band's return is the same it is Aiden Cher, who's from The Middle, just currently on TV. So there you go. She was much younger, obviously, given that The Middle I think has only been running since 2000 something. Actually, no, she's been on The Middle for a long time. I didn't know that show was on that long. Anyways, okay, so let's talk boy bands.
Well, so yes. I realize that Mike has not talked about the urtext of any of these episodes yet, and I'd love to hear about both the last one and this one.
I think the urtext in Flying Fish Zombification is just kind of the mass of zombie movies, because Wendy and the middleman are trying to negotiate between the different kind of different versions and the in-universe lore about zombies versus Wendy's media-based lore about zombies. In the Wikipedia page for Boy Band Superfan Interrogation, it mentions Catch-22 gets a comic book flavor. I've not read Catch-22, so I'm not sure. That may in fact be the urtext there. And then there's also a kind of cultural touchstone in the idea of boy bands and, you know, gigantic fandom being able to, I think, date back to the Beatles. In terms of spontaneous preteen fan excitement being this almost dangerous, overwhelming thing, then getting turned into interdimensional transport power.
Well, the catch 22, the premise of a catch 22 is that no matter which action you take, it just ends badly for everybody. So when they're having to make the decision of whether or not to turn on the device, right, their choice is either I'll risk the annihilation of the entire planet by not allowing that the device to be turned on, or actually possibly kill a bunch of people in order to prevent the alternative. So every action they take is, it's, there's no good out of this. There's no, like, right, action that works out. I mean, obviously it does work out in the end.
Yeah, because if they stop Varsity Fan Club, then Ida also gets destroyed because of how all the tech was set up.
Right. Right. Yeah, so it's all bad, right? Yeah, but in any case, oh, cool. So there we go.
Get to see the middleman doing a magic trick.
Yeah. I love the
inappropriately too.
He's standing there with the stupid duck in the air, and it's just going wah, wah. Yeah, and then he thinks a card trick is how you follow that up. Yeah,
this episode kind of reminded me of a little bit of Third Rock from the Sun and Men in Black. Third Rock from the Sun is basically having an alien undercover posing, and in the wrong, quote unquote, wrong, in an unexpected body given their profession, and Men in Black because, you know, we got wormholes, we have aliens running around, we have the middleman trying to distract people from the wormhole. It felt very Men in Black to me.
Interesting. Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that, yeah. But it's fair, yeah. Yeah. Something I really did like about this is I love that they played, on all of the kind of tropes and cliches of boy bands. I mean, there's that moment when Wendy is, I think she's like showing something like the band on her TV because she doesn't understand who Varsity Fan Club is, and Lacey just starts singing the song and doing the dance moves. Yeah. Right? She's doing like the whole thing. We see that kind of all of these different ways in which people obsess over band boys or become fans of these things, and it's one of those things that kind of, I think, offsets us when we initially get to the little girl's room, right, and we see all of the posters everywhere. And our first instinct is to suspect that, well, she's just a super fan, and that's not actually the truth, right? Her interest is an entirely different, non-fanish interest. It's actually murdery. I do like that it explores that throughout the episode.
And Middleman does the spot analysis on the posters to place each boy in their boy band archetype.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Julia, what did you think?
Yeah, I really liked that it kind of subverted your ideas of what teenage fangirls are, because it gives us this teenage fangirl who appears to be obsessed with the band, but actually she's a super badass alien military person. And so, like, about the point when she starts just going down into, my name is this, my rank is this, and that's all she'll give them.
Yeah.
It's pretty brilliant. And then she gets to, it's a brilliant disguise because she gets to go backstage to the concert and she's like, I really love this and I'm trying to collect all of the signatures from everybody who worked with this band. So could you sign my whatever, my t-shirt or something? And the security guard's like, sure. And she's like, yeah, I'm going to kick your ass.
Yeah. One of the other things that this episode, I think, did really, really well is, you know, the relationship between Wendy and Ida has basically throughout the series been tumultuous, right? I don't know if Ida actually feels anything, but Ida presents this sort of sarcasm. She constantly calls her a drug addict and all these kinds of things. And this is, you know, we're to assume that they just don't like each other, but they're just like colleagues. They just have to work and just get over it. But I love that this episode started to explore Wendy's kind of deeper appreciation for Ida, because as soon as Ida is out of commission, right, the middleman is basically willing to sacrifice her in order to save the planet, and Wendy's like, we've got to find another way because we need Ida. And I love that. I wish the later episodes that we had watched had started to deal with that a bit more, but I like that they went around to kind of to dispel that notion so that we kind of see that relationship softening a little bit, even though obviously Ida is still saucy and sassy, or whatever the appropriate word would be, I think she's just an uber sarcastic, quick whip kind of person. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I also really like that the aliens decide to disguise themselves as a boy band, because the only thing powerful enough to actually open up a wormhole portal so that they can go back to where they want to go is the power of teenage euphoric screams.
Yes!
Yeah.
I love it!
Yeah, if this were made now, I think that Varsity Fan Club would take the form of John Green-style YA authors.
Well, I don't know. I mean, now there's One Direction, so...
It's true.
I feel like boy bands are a lasting truth that way. But if it was happening in the literary world, definitely John Green or Neil Gaiman.
Yeah, Nerdfighteria for world domination.
This is great. Well, do you want to skip over to the...
Shall we move on to the icy cold waters of the North Atlantic?
Yes,
we should. The icy cold waters of the North Atlantic.
All right, Julia, I'm going to give you the job of describing the cursed tuba contingency.
The cursed tuba contingency. So in this one, it starts out with the middleman going to a movie to see Ride Lonesome, which is his favorite movie, but he's never seen it all the way through, it turns out, because he always gets called away before the end. And Lacey, who has sort of secretly been following him, turning up at the same movie and them having a flirtation. So all of the time that she's been calling him Pillow Lips kind of comes to a head in this episode. And they meet at the movie theater and there's obvious chemistry, but then his middle watch goes off and she's like, I know that sound, and he leaves. And it turns out that someone has drowned in his hotel room. How is this possible? Well, it turns out that there's a cursed tuba that was on the Titanic, and the dude who was the tuba player rescued himself and his tuba, claiming it was a baby, and got into a lifeboat with it, and has been cursed to eternally live as long as the tuba is intact, which means you can kill him and it's painful, but he comes right back to life. So then the rest of the episode is about them trying to stop him and stop the tuba from killing everybody when there is a guy with a giant yacht who is having a Titanic reenactment party and plans to have the tuba played at the party, which will, of course, kill everyone. And then, of course, Lacey and Noser end up on the ship as well. So it's very, very high stakes for Wendy and the middleman.
And obviously, we have to remember that the yacht is 86 feet longer than the Titanic.
And 3 feet longer than the Queen Mary.
Correct.
Yeah. That is true.
It's a very important detail we can't forget. Yeah.
Yeah. And we get the advantage of our leads putting on fancy period clothes, and then also fighting in said fancy period clothes, and a funny jab at CSI type investigations when when the tuba player impersonates a CSI guy, and then the middleman and the in disguise tuba player kind of banter back and forth in detective mode, and the middleman is very impressed, and then the actual CSI guys come in, take their glasses off, and everyone's confused.
Yeah.
Yeah. I learned it with the tuba.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was an interesting way to make the Titanic a much more interesting story by sort of playing on cursed elements. I mean, because like this show does things that are more fantastic and then more scientific oriented, and this is one of those. It's just purely like ghosty fantastic, and that's followed obviously in episode 8, which is literally dealing with like souls and ghosts. But I love that's the element that it went with. That we have this sort of cursed tuba that can be used essentially to do mass just damage. You could just kill millions of people, right? If you played a tuba on, like, you know, prime time, you could kill anybody listening to it, because they would all get filled up with the water.
Yeah, the icy North waters of the North Atlantic.
Right. I think I actually forgot to explain how the tuba works. So anybody who hears it will drown in the icy waters of the North Atlantic.
Right.
And also, this is... a brilliant point where we get to see Wendy the middleman using one of their many, many fake IDs, this time as representatives from the American Shrimp and Crab Amalgamated Processors, ASCAP. And I love the fact that they say, they like flash their cards and they say, we're from ASCAP. And the CSI people are like, oh, the shrimp guys? As if this is like totally normal. that ASCAP would totally have law enforcement officers. Yep.
I like the role reversal here, because here we get the middleman gets interrupted while on his downtime again and again by Wendy, which I thought was a nice reversal from the usual pattern where Wendy's downtime gets interrupted. For once, the middleman gets that shoe on the other foot. We also get a little bit of Roxy. Not much Roxy, but we get a little bit of Roxy, who's interested in magical artifacts for obvious reasons, being a succubus.
Yeah. Well, and something that really sticks with me in this episode is the fact that we get to investigate more of the middleman's close association with the Western genre in terms of how he identifies with leads in that genre, and kind of it allows us to juxtapose a kind of pulp superhero hero and a Western hero and see where there are points of continuity and points of divergence, as incarnated in the middleman, who strides both worlds, because he's identifies with the Western but lives in the world of the superhero.
Yeah.
It also does send up Titanic a little bit, because there is that brilliant point when Wendy and the middleman both get captured and tied up inside the belly of the ship. Very similarly to the position in which Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio find themselves in Titanic.
I've forgotten that. I haven't seen it.
And like, I haven't seen Titanic since it came out in 1997, but when they get tied up like that, I'm like, oh yeah, that's totally the same position that Kate and Leo are in. And I love that they kind of do that, and it's an obvious visual echo on purpose, and then also that Lacey gets to come in and save them.
Well, and then they follow it through with, Lacey, because Lacey's been kind of romancing the middleman throughout the episode, and her first response is, "Nose or get the axe, we'll chop it off," like in a big romantic gesture kind of thing. And it's like, or you could just get my universal key out of my pocket. And Nose are like, well, but can I just use the axe? Because of course that's the exact scene, right? That she uses the axe, and it's this big. It is a romantic gesture, right? He's like, "I have faith in you. You can do it." And I love that as well. Because Lacey's kind of a big softy in the middle there.
There's one beat that there's one bet that I think that the show missed, and I wish at some point. Near My God to Thee had been played, like by the string quartet or something. Because that's the song that was the band was playing on the Titanic as it went down. And it's also fun trivia fact. It's also the music that's going to be played on the infamous Doomsday tape of CNN if it ever gets played. That. When the end of civilization. Any of you ever seen Gremlins 2?
Yes.
Yep. Remember when Clampett puts that little tape on about the end of it? Thanks to the end of civilization, the Clampett News Network is going off the air. They're playing Near My God to Thee over those pictures of the waterfalls and stuff. So that's the classic end of civilization, end of the world sort of song to me. And this episode could have used it.
Well, the tuba player references it. In his accounting, right?
Yeah, but I was hoping I'd actually hear it, but I was a little disappointed.
Hmm. Okay. All right.
Okay, that was a little bit of a downer, sorry, guys.
Oh, it's okay. It's interesting. Okay.
So, Julie? Yes, and this also does... Ride Lonesome is a real movie. I haven't actually seen it, and this reminded me again that I probably should see it at some point, because it very clearly the plot is referenced, and I kind of want to know what the movie is actually about and what happens.
Yeah, and Lacey mentions, kind of tantalizing mentions, the ending is not what you expect and all this stuff. Yeah.
My God, it is a real... I don't know what's real anymore. It's a real movie. And Randolph Scott is a real person. Okay. This show is just, like, I don't even know. Well, interesting. Okay.
All right, shall we move on to college?
I think that's fair. Yeah, Julie, you okay with that?
Yep.
Awesome. Well, so I'm not going to describe this, but I do want to just say that this is the only episode I didn't like. Of all of the ones we've watched so far, this is the only one where I just kind of was like, I don't like this one at all. But maybe we'll get into that in a minute.
That's interesting. I'm curious as to why you didn't like it.
All of the other episodes, I felt like they make fun of tropes, or they make fun of, you know, kind of ideas that we see repeated a lot in genre. And this one, it just felt like we're making fun of a stereotype of sorority girls. And
it wasn't really making fun of sorority girls, because the sorority girls weren't actually bad. In fact, one of the sorority girls is instrumental in helping Wendy process what's going on between her and Lacey and Tyler. And it's actually showing you that sorority girls are quite a bit more complex than you might first think. And that also, like, the person who's the evil villain of the piece is thinking of them as bad stereotypes, but is herself actually much more evil.
Well, yeah, she's certainly evil. I don't like the stereotype. It just kind of irked me. I don't know. It's hard to describe. It threw me off, and I never really kind of got back on the horse, if that makes sense.
Every reaction is valid. One thing I love about this is because it is the Ghostbusters episode.
Yes.
And Ghostbusters episode, Ghostbusters references abound, and they include the Moscow rules. So there's a little bit of James Bondiness, and Wendy goes undercover. So it's Wendy herself directly exploring these stereotypes, and back and forth with the middleman and with Ida about technology and trying to blend into this organization, because it strikes me that it seems like Wendy was definitely not a part of a sorority at any point. But then, thanks to Barbara Thornfield, MD, PhD, she can get access to the secret cheer slash handshake. So there's a lot of callbacks as the series continuity builds, and there's more kind of breadth to the characters and their connections.
Okay.
Yeah, and I kind of get the impression that Wendy goes into it expecting the sorority girls to kind of be empty-headed and whatever, and her expectations are a little bit turned upside down as well.
Yeah, I mean, they are. I think... So let me see if I can maybe make my issue a little bit more clear. Because I agree that if you look at the whole of the episode, there are moments where a lot of those expectations are subverted, including Wendy's. I think that the scene that bugged me the most was when they get the... I forget the name of the pledger, right, who can right. see and speak to ghosts. And they have that scene where he's enacting... Like, there's no reason for him to sit there and pretend to be talking like they're talking, because he's not being possessed. So he's doing this kind of, like, really stereotypical kind of, I don't, like, ditzy kind of person as he's relaying what they're talking about. And that scene goes on, and then they kind of do one of those cuts where it's implied that this has been going on for, like, minutes and minutes, like 20 minutes or something. And he's just talking about their arguments about their kind of mundane everyday lives. And I think that's the moment that really bugged me, because I just didn't... Why are we going to this place when clearly what's important in this moment is these sorority girls have been unfairly maligned and have had their, like, souls ripped out? It seems like you had a goal and then that was solved, but why do we need him to be... he's dressed up as a woman. That seemed to be enough. I felt like it was going that extra line. It was just going that extra step for me.
For me, I saw it as a place where the kind of ups and downs of sorority life were brought very much to the forefront, where we have these girls who are, you know, they're all leaders within the community, and because they're in a house with tons of other people, there are things that go unspoken, and you build assumptions and you get on people's nerves. And like, as somebody who used to live in a group house, because I was in a co-op in grad school, that I think rings very true to me. And it was at least as much about finally getting a chance, because you're outside of yourself, literally, to get things off your chest that otherwise you would have kept in.
Yeah, I have no experience with this sort of dynamic, but I can see how Mike's would be valid, how Mike could tap into what a sorority is, just having this analogous experience of living in a group and all the messy group dynamics and things that get said and don't get said. And yeah, that scene did bug me a little bit too, Sean. I mean, otherwise I like the episode a lot, because I mean, There's Ghostbusters references all over the place. The Egon Spengler Award, Reitman University, and there's a key mastering gatekeeper reference. It's just like all over the place. I kind of like the plot about it. It kind of reminds me almost like a Revenge of the Nerds in sort of way. It's sort of the antagonist trying to get one up over on the Greeks, for example, which goes back to that movie.
It's also got a little bit of Animal House in it. There's even a point where one of the characters is wearing the iconic college sweatshirt.
Yeah.
And the whole point of Animal House is, of course, having a wild party at a frat or sorority, so.
Which, of course, is exactly what occurs, right? Because
Because that's the evil mastermind's plan, which is sheer elegance and simplicity, is to get the charter revoked by having a party so wild the cops are called.
Yes, and I believe she says it would like rival Caligula or something like that.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yes, and then one of the sorority girls is like, "Who's she?"
Yeah. Well, of course, like, who knows what Caligula is?
Oh, it's totally believable that someone wouldn't. It's just, it was amusing.
It is amusing, yeah. It is interesting, though, that that part of her plan is... Am I wrong in thinking that part of her plan is to use their bodies for, like, sex as well?
Of the party? Her plan is to get her friends to upload into their bodies so that she can get them to do things that are debauched, whether that involves them actually having sex or just drinking a lot and taking off their clothes and dancing around in public, so that the university authorities will be very upset. But whatever it is, it involves lots of like things that they would not normally do and that they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess that was a little troubling, because when you get to the end of the episode, right, there we have this joke about, you know, what happens to super geniuses, like they'll get sent to Greenland or whatever. And there's that joke at the end where Wendy's like, "You're going to love Greenland," right? Because the villain is a genius. Like, she's discovered things that no other scientist has. And I don't know if maybe I just missed that was not like a... that she didn't mean, like, "We're actually going to send you to whatever Greenland is a metaphor for."
That's not a metaphor. Because
I think
I'm sorry, go ahead, Mike.
I think they are literally taken off to Greenland, where they are put into a, like, heroic think tank in order to rehabilitate them.
Also, there's the whole Tyler Ford thing, because the middleman mentions if Tyler remembers everything, then he's going to get shipped off to a place like Greenland. So it's kind of... So it's like, I guess, like, this is a place you get exiled if you insist on knowing too much behind the veil, as it were.
Right. So despite the fact that this person has done, like, really horrible things, like, the implication at the end is she's going to get sent off to this mystical think tank place, presumably in Greenland. Am I right in thinking that that's exactly what's going to happen? It's not a joke?
Where she is...
Where she's going to be, like, confined and supervised and not allowed to do things like that.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's not a joke. That's what's going to happen to her. She's going to wind up in Greenland.
That's a little skeevy.
Well, I mean, it's sort of like if you look at, for instance, during World War II, if there were really good Nazi scientists, sometimes we didn't put them in prison. We took them and made them work for us.
Yep, Von Braun. Yeah. Oh, it's true. It's a really heavy subject when you like wipe away the jokes and actually think about it.
Yeah, because it's about being a prisoner in your own body, or being taken away from your own body, and kind of loss of bodily autonomy and all that kind of stuff.
So yeah, what she did to the sorority girls, she's going to have done to herself in turn, and just in a different form.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting interpretation, Paul. Yeah. Okay. All right.
But cool. Let's talk about the romance.
Yes.
Oh.
Because we didn't mention that in the tuba episode, right? That Wendy was like, "Oh, you can't be dating my roommate because
we're dangerous." Well, and it's not just that Wendy said that; it's that the middleman knows that he needs to really be. That's part of the Western deal, you know. It's called Ride Lonesome. It's not called Ride Together with the One You Love.
I know, but they're like the cutest couple ever.
That is totally true, and it would be great if they could get together.
Oh, yeah, really sad. But please, Mike, explain the romance in episode 8.
So in episode 8, Tyler Ford, who we met in the Sino-Mexican Revelation, we have Tyler Ford has returned, and he's trying to piece together his two-day amnesia from when he got beat up by the luchadores. So he's retracing his steps to the booty chest and discovers that he met a lovely lady who he hit it off with, and then got the address in a kind of some one or another type of violation of employer privacy laws, and went and found her. But who she found is, or who he found is Lacey rather than Wendy. And Wendy kind of sees this happen and doesn't step in. It, or isn't in a good position to step in and be like, no, so it was totally me. Like, make moon eyes at me, not Lacey, me. So she's trying to be all self-sacrificing, and then Lacey and Tyler are starting to get together, and they go out for food at the Vegan Palace, and Wendy doesn't want to be a third wheel, especially because she's super into Tyler. And then the sorority sister helps Wendy kind of negotiate this with Lacey, because Wendy feels like she's already pushed too many times against Lacey, especially given what's happened with the middleman. And it's all like there's a very intricate kind of social dynamic that's happening as the B plot while the A plot is going on. And then in the end, the intimation of future smooching.
Yep.
Yeah, and all of this is helped by Wendy's sorority sister friend who eventually literally just takes Wendy's phone and tells Lacey, like, look, you know Wendy likes Tyler.
Yes. Yeah. Because bizarre love triangles are basically her superpower.
Yeah.
I think is what she says.
Yeah, she says something to that effect, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and it is kind of cute because they do geek out over her analysis of that really terrible zombie movie that she loves to watch, right? She considers it to be a palate cleanser.
Definitely
for when she watches
movie,
The Night of Living Dead again. So that she is watching it as though it has never existed, is what she says. And they have this like really deep conversation briefly until Lacey, I think, figures out what's going on and has to kind of put a stop to it. But that comes up yet again, right? Because at the end of the episode, deciding he no longer wishes to continue eating vegan food for reasons, he buys a whole bunch of wings from the pirate-themed bar.
The pirate-themed restaurant with the scaly head waitresses.
Yes, and rents the terrible zombie movie.
We should do Zombies of Moratau for torture cinema.
Is it a real movie?
Yeah! It's got a 5.1 at IMDb.
Oh my god,
From 1957.
No idea. Yes,
apparently the zombies aren't gory and they guard treasure. So
right?
I think we do need to do this for Torture Cinema, Sean. I think it's a moral imperative.
I'm adding it to the Torture Cinema list tonight. Well, okay. And we're basically, I think, pretty close to time here, so we should start closing up. Any last final bits that people want to add?
I think this set of episodes really starts getting the gears working on the middleman. We get to see character development. We get to see very funny bits. I like these episodes a lot now that I'm more immersed into the middleman universe.
Okay. Julie, any last thoughts?
No.
Nope.
I'm good.
All right. Mike?
Yeah, this is the eighth episode in particular is one that really sticks with me. And this whole series is definitely, as I said in the last episode, had a big impact on me kind of artistically. So it's very fun to dig back into it. You know, just like every time you go back to a favorite book, you always get to see something new in it. And it's fun to share in that revisiting experience with everybody. So thanks, y'all.
Yay.
Yay, middleman.
Yay, middleman.
Also, you get to see a lot more about the middleman's core values in this series of episodes. Like, he is telling Wendy she really needs to focus on the job, but then when it turns out that Pip is plagiarizing, that actually trumps that, and it's okay to use middleman personal device stuff to solve that problem.
Oh, yeah, and he uses, like, a truth grenade.
Oh, yeah.
The truth bomb.
The truth bomb, and everyone's telling all of the like random, completely ridiculous truths about themselves. But it doesn't work on the middleman because he's clever and he can figure out ways. Right when she asks him, "What's your name?" and he says, "It's the same name as my father," and then he walks away.
But it's just the truth, just not all of it.
Right, it's very clever on his part. So, well. Perfect. All right. Well, I think that does it for this episode. So we're going to do the next four and then we'll be done because that's all there is to it.
All there was.
Unfortunately. Hopefully there will be 6,000 more seasons of this show made via Netflix soon. But we'll see. So, well, thanks everybody for joining joining together, I guess. This is so awkward. Somebody just end the show.
Our crawl.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I pass in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.